But such a thing was out of the question, for I had expressly told the coolies that I intended to go into the country of the Lhotse tribes to collect plants, and the road to Lutskiang went through Londera and they turned in a direction exactly opposite to the Kakapo. Very disturbed, and reflecting that each step added a difficulty to my approaching flight, I followed the two Tibetans who meant to take me to a wooded tableland about 10 miles higher, where they knew of a good camping ground. As far as they could see, Yongdan and I scarcely cast a glance at the country in the direction of the Doka Pass, but in reality we did our best to impress on our memory the shape and peculiarities of the landscape which would help us when we had to cross it on the next night. Our passage in Londera was as inconspicuous as we could have wished. Not one of the villagers whom we met appeared to take any particular notice of us. This most happy circumstance was perhaps due to the fact that an American naturalist worked in the vicinity and employed a large number of people. No doubt the villagers thought that we were on our way to join him as assistants. After having proceeded for a few miles on the Lhotskiang path, turning my back to my real goal, I thought it imprudent to proceed farther. Safety required that plenty of time be allowed for the long tramp on the opposite side of Londera, so that dawn should find us far away from the village, having, if possible, reached the pilgrimage road. Once there, we could easily pretend to have come from any northern Tibetan part we cared to name, in order to get round the sacred mountain. I had hesitated a long time in choosing the road I would take in order to enter independent Tibet, the one I preferred, or perhaps I should say the one which circumstances seemed to be thrusting upon me, is followed every autumn by many travelers. By taking it I foresaw that I should run the danger of frequent meetings. Not that this inconvenience was without its favorable aspect, since our tracks could be more easily lost amongst those of pilgrims from various Tibetan regions, each of whom spoke in different dialect, and whose womenfolk had a variety of different dress and coiffures. The little peculiarities of my accent, my features, or my clothes would more easily be overlooked on such a road, and if inquiries were to be made, they would have to embrace so many people that confusion might very likely follow to my advantage. But of course I sincerely hoped that no inquiry would be made, and that we should meet as few people as possible during the first few weeks of our trek. We had reached a point where the road commanded the view of the valley at the entrance of which Londera was built. It was covered with a dense jungle in the middle of which flowed a clear stream. A trail descended to it from the road, and it was here that I paused for a few minutes, wondering once more how I should get rid of my two unwanted followers. I soon made up my mind. "My feet are swollen and sore," I said to the men. "I cannot walk any longer. Let us go down near the stream, and we will make tea and camp." They were not astonished. Truly my feet had been hurt by my Chinese rope sandals, and the coolies had seen them bleeding when I had washed them in a stream. We went down, and I chose a small clearing surrounded by thick bushes and pitched my tent. The presence of the water, and the protection afforded against the wind by the thickets would certainly have justified my choice of the spot had the two peasants or any other persons questioned me about the selection of this rather gloomy place. A fire was lighted, and I gave the coolies a good meal. Yongdan and I endeavored to swallow a little tsampu, although the imminence of our departure, the fear of seeing our plans upset at the last minute, had left us little appetite. However, when the meal was finished, I ordered one of the men to go up the hill to cut some dry logs, since only twigs could be found near us. When he had gone, I explained to his companion that I had no need of him because I meant to stay there about a week collecting plants on the neighboring mountains, before I went to Lhotskiang. When necessary, I added, I would hire a man from the villagers of Londera to carry my luggage. He understood and, well pleased with good wages, he started immediately for home, convinced, of course, that the man who had gone to cut the wood would remain to attend on me. Flour made of roasted barley, the staple food of Tibetans. The latter was told exactly the same thing, when he came back with the wood, but as I did not want him to meet his companion for some time, lest they should discuss my strange plan of camping alone, I added that, as I could not proceed at once to Lhotskiang, He was to carry there a letter and a parcel. From there, he could return to his village by a direct road, without coming back to Londoner. The parcel contained a few clothes, a gift to the poor. Must I relate that, shut in the small tent, Yongdan and I had again examined our baggage and, finding it still too heavy, we had given up the waterproof ground sheet that was meant to keep us, when sleeping, from direct contact with the damp or frozen ground. Yongdan and I discarded also the only pieces of spare clothing we had kept. Nothing was now left us except the clothes we were wearing. We had not even a blanket, although we knew that, during the winter, we should have to cross high, snowy ranges, passes of over 18,000 feet, and as much food as possible had to be carried, since we did not wish to show ourselves in the villages for at least a fortnight. Later on, when crossing desert regions, a full load of provisions would again be indispensable. Success and even life might depend upon it. The small package was addressed to a missionary whom I had never seen and who had probably never heard of me. Such was my plan of ridding myself of my last coolie. He went away, as satisfied as his comrade, with a few dollars in his pocket, believing that the other peasant had been sent on some errand in the neighborhood from which he would return before evening. What these two said, a few days later, when they met after having rounded the same range, one on the northern and his friend on the southern side, must have been amusing, but I never heard it. All necessary arrangements had been made. We stood, Yongdan and I, in the thick jungle, alone and free. The novelty of our situation bewildered us a little. For months, during the long journey from the sands of Gobi to Yunnan, we had been discussing the way in which we could disappear, as we used to say, and assume other personalities. Now, the hour had come and we were to start that very night for the Doka Pass which now forms the border of independent Tibet. Let us drink a cup of tea, I said to the young Lama, and then you will start on a scouting tour. At any rate, we should reach the foot of the Kakapo track without meeting anybody, and be out of sight from the village before daybreak. Hastily I revived the fire. Yongdan brought water from the stream, and we prepared the Tibetan tea, with butter and salt, in the simple manner of poor travelers who cannot enjoy the luxury of a churn to mix it. I may as well explain immediately the composition of our canteen. We had only one aluminium pot, which was our kettle, teapot, and saucepan all in one. There was also one llama wooden bowl for Yongdan, an aluminium bowl for myself, two spoons, and a Chinese traveling case containing one long knife and chopsticks, which could be hung from the belt. That was all. We did not intend to indulge in refined cooking. Our meals were to be those of the common Tibetan travelers, that is to say, sampa, mixed with buttered tea, or eaten nearly dry, kneaded with butter. When circumstances would allow, we would make a soup. Forks were useless with such a diet, and even our two cheap spoons could not be produced freely, as they were of a foreign pattern such as only affluent Tibetans possess. Our jupas, pilgrims traveling on foot and often begging their food, as we pretended to be, have none. In fact, these spoons became, later on, the occasion of a short drama in which I nearly killed a man. I shall tell the story in due course. The tea drunk, Yongdan started. Hours passed, night had fallen. I remained seated near the fire which I did not dare to let blaze, fearing that it might be seen from afar and betray our presence. The remains of the tea, kept as a last cordial to cheer our departure, were shimmering on the embers, the rising moon tinged with bluish and russet hues the melancholy depths of the valley. All was silence and solitude. Footnote. Elevation, 18,400 feet above sea level. What had I dared to dream? Verpower my mind. Whatever might be the future, I would not shrink from it. Stop here. Go no farther. Such were the commands of a few Western politicians, to explorers, savants, missionaries, scholars, to all, in fact, except their agents, who travelled freely, wherever they were sent, in this so-called forbidden land. What right had they to erect barriers around a country which was not even lawfully theirs? Many travelers had been stopped on their way to Lhasa, and had accepted failure. I would not. I had taken the challenge by my oath on the Iron Bridge and was now ready to show what a woman can do. As I was thus musing, Yongdan emerged suddenly from the bushes. Strangely lit by the moon, he looked a little like a legendary mountain spirit. Briefly he reported the result of his scouting. To avoid the village we should have to cross a rickety footbridge higher up the valley, and follow the stream downward on the opposite bank. Perhaps it was possible to make a direct descent by wading in the river itself past any village house that might be perched upon the bank. This would certainly be a shortcut. We were stopped after a few weeks' journey and led me through a very interesting part of the province of Kham. I had then every opportunity of studying at first hand the conditions of the inhabitants, as the Lhasa government had succeeded in establishing complete ascendancy there after its victory over the Chinese. But, as people were in the fields nearby, he had not been able to test the depth of the water. Whichever road we might choose, we could not avoid passing in front of a few houses between the small bridge on the stream flowing out of the valley where we pitched our camp, and the large one on the tributary of the Mekong, which we had seen on our arrival. When we had crossed that second bridge, we could look for the bypath which was to lead us to the pilgrimage road. Yongdan had seen it clearly, winding up the steep slope, but he had failed to discover the exact point from which it branched from the bank of the river. With these vague ideas, I hurriedly set out. It was already late and we could not guess how many miles we should have to tramp that night until we could reach a spot which afforded some degree of safety. Was my load heavy on my shoulders? Were its rough straps cutting my flesh? Indeed they were. I felt it later, but at that moment I was not aware of it. I was aware of nothing. I knocked myself against sharp rocks. I tore my hands and my face in the thorny bushes. I was dead to all sensation, stiffened, hypnotized by the will to succeed. For several hours we trudged in the valley. We had first climbed up to the main road, and then, skirting isolated farms, tried the passage in the stream. It proved impossible at night time. The water was rather high, the current swift and breaking against boulders. We should have fallen in 2 minutes. And so we again directed our steps in search of the footbridge. Several times we lost our road. The trails that my young friend had marked in the day were difficult to find by the dim light of the moon, veiled in mist. At last we found ourselves on an easy but very winding track on the opposite bank. It led tortuously beside the stream, and we were exasperated by the precious moments lost in following it. When at last we caught sight of the village, we put our loads down, drank a draught of the clear water that flowed past us, swallowed a granule of strychnine to rouse fresh energy in our tired bodies, and took the dreaded passage on the run. A bridge, the houses, the second and larger bridge, safely passed. We stood at the foot of the wild and solitary hill on which a narrow, twisting trail led to other tracks and paths and roads leading into the very heart of Tibet, the forbidden capital of the Lamas. A dog had given a low, suppressed bark when we were near the river, a single dog, in that village, where a dozen or more of these rather fierce animals wandered to and fro all night. It reminded me of the Indian tales relating the nightly flight of those sons of good family, who, in quest of the supreme deliverance, abandon their home to take to the religious life of the sannyasin. In order, we read, to make their flight easier, the gods lulled the men to sleep and silenced the dogs. So had it been with me, and smilingly I return thanks to the invisible friends who protected my departure. In our haste to be off we overlooked a small landslide just in front of us, which was in reality the beginning of the bypath leading upward that had fallen in. We searched for the road along the riverbank until we neared a steep gorge which afforded no means of ascent and we were thus forced to return to the bridge. Another half hour was wasted here. We were in full sight of the village and trembled for fear of being noticed. Moreover, the right track, which we found a little after midnight, happened to be extremely steep and sandy. Heavily loaded as we could only make slow progress, in spite of our strenuous efforts, being compelled to stop frequently, out of breath. It was terrible, and my feelings could well be compared to those of a nightmare in which the dreamer imagines himself to be pursued by murderers and tries his utmost to run away, but cannot move his feet. Toward the end of the night we reached a gloomy spot sheltered by large trees. Our steps awakened a number of big birds perched on the branches, which flew away noisily. A streamlet flowed nearby and Yongnan, who had not enjoyed a minute's rest since the morning of the previous day, craved a refreshing bowl of tea. Thirst parched my mouth and I shared the desire of my companion, but nevertheless I was most reluctant to stop. This dark place, the only one where water was obtainable, did not appear to me very safe. It might possibly be haunted by leopards and panthers, of which there are many on these hills. Above all, I wished to put as great a distance as possible between us and Londra. Had I been alone, I would have suffered no matter what agony, and would have crept on my knees if I could no longer stand, rather than delay a single minute. But the exhausted lama's fatigue overcame prudence. Nothing could be done. He fell rather than sat upon the wet ground, and I went in search of fuel. The hot drink was most comforting. Unfortunately, his new sense of well-being lulled my companion to sleep. I could have cried. Each minute wasted on that path diminished our chances of success. However, in such cases nothing is to be done. Sleep is a necessity that cannot be resisted. Nevertheless, Yongdan was not allowed a long rest and we continued on our way. The solitude reassured us. The sun had long since risen and we were still climbing when we heard a voice above us. Then, without exchanging a single word, panic-stricken, Yongdan and I threw ourselves out of the path and rushed like scared game, through the thick jungle, our only idea being to escape from sight. I found myself, without being able to remember how I had come there, on an old stony landslide surrounded by thorny bushes. Of my companion there was no trace. However, he had not gone far and we soon found each other. But we did not dare to walk again in broad daylight. Woodcutters, cattle drovers, or others might be going down to Londra and talk about us there. Pilgrims might perhaps follow that path, overtake us, notice something peculiar in our appearance, and repeat it in gossip on the other side of the border. We expected the worst, anxious to give bad luck as little chance as possible. We therefore spent the first day of our journey squatting under the trees. From our resting place we could hear, higher up, invisible folk driving equally invisible cattle. A woodcutter appeared on an opposite slope. I watched him for some time. He sang prettily as he piled his logs and doubtless was not in the least aware of the agony he was causing a foreign woman. The autumn foliage probably screened us completely from the gaze of distant observers, and the villagers did not suspect our presence. Nevertheless, in my fear of having been seen, I was filled with the most pessimistic ideas. I almost believed that failure was awaiting me and that I had come here in vain from faraway Turkestan, across the whole of China. Soon after sunset we began our nocturnal tramp. When darkness came we saw several fires higher up on the hill. We could not be sure that the winding path which we followed would not lead us to them, and we were very much worried. Coalmen or, perhaps, pilgrims were camped there and the prospect of arriving at night amongst Tibetans by the Londra track did not please us in the least, for such a meeting would have been the occasion for many embarrassing questions from inquisitive people. We remained for a long time seated on the grass in a clearing, waiting for the moon to rise. We could not see the trail, yet all the time we could see these alarming, glowing fires. They gave a peculiarly disquieting and demoniacal aspect to the black, indistinct landscape of pines and huge rocks jutting around them in the dark starlit sky. How thankful we were when we saw them far behind us and were certain that we could not meet the people near them. Soon afterwards we arrived at a small court and marking the junction of our track and the pilgrims' road. This is a Tibetan monument erected to hold religious objects or the remains of great departed lamas. The latter was a rather large mule path, and walking became easy and pleasant. To have reached this spot without meeting anybody was indeed fortunate. If my luck held out, I might, with equal fortune, cross the Doka Pass and reach the district of Menkong. I could then congratulate myself on having made the most important step toward final success, F6R, in that country many roads cross, bringing together travelers from various directions. Our tracks would be easily lost, and with a little cleverness we could lose ourselves in the anonymous mass of Tibetan pilgrims whom the officials do not condescend to honor with so much as a single glance. Thirst was torturing us still more than upon the previous night when we reached a large roaring mountain torrent which cut across the road. A small bridge spanned it rather high above the water which rushed, white with foam, amidst a chaos of boulders. Yongdan thought only of his thirst, and wished to go down the road immediately to drink. This was dangerous, since, in the darkness, he could not see the obstacles which might cause him to stumble and roll into the torrent, which would have immediately carried him away. I demonstrated with the obstinate fellow, but he argued that as water was so scarce, seeing that we had found none since the previous night, it was indeed possible it would be hours before we struck water again. I could not contradict him, but thirst was preferable to being drowned. I therefore ordered him to cross the footbridge. On the other side, the bank was less steep and an easy way down could be seen. Although time was precious, and I did not like to light a fire so close to the road, I was thinking of halting, when, to our dismay, we heard a voice calling us. It was that of a man who offered us red embers to kindle a fire, and even a cup of ready-made tea to begin with. We remained motionless, speechless. We had talked in English a few minutes before. Had that man heard us? "Who are you?" asked another voice. "Why are you walking at night?" We still could see nobody, but the sound came from a huge tree. I thought that it might be hollow and that travelers had taken it as hostelry for the night. "We are pilgrims," answered Yongdan. "Dokpas from Amdo. We cannot bear the heat of this country. When we walk in the sunshine, we get fever. So we tramp around the holy hill at night." That was quite a plausible reason. The man who had asked the question asked nothing more, but Yongdan continued, "And you, who are you?" "We, too, are pilgrims." "Well, goodbye," I said, to cut the talk short. "We will still walk a little, and camp the next time we find water." So ended the first chance meeting on our way to Lhasa. We congratulated each other that it did not happen while we were still on the track climbing from Londera, but at the same time we learned that even night marches were not absolutely secure, and that we had to be prepared at any hour and at any place to explain, in a way that awoke no suspicion whatever, the reason of our doings. We continued our way for several hours without finding further traces of water. I felt exhausted and walked mechanically, half asleep. Once I thought that we were approaching a hut built on the road and turned over in my mind what I would say and do if I met Tibetans. But the hut turned out to be a passage between two great rocks. At last utter exhaustion compelled us to rest. The site was not in the least fit for camping. The exceedingly narrow trail skirted a stony, natural wall, and, on the other side, ended perpendicularly. We lay down on rocky mattress whose roughness we unpleasantly felt through our clothes and endeavored to remember even in our sleep that we were perched on the edge of a precipice whose depth was unfathomable in the night. In such wise we spent the second happy night of our wonderful adventure. Day had not yet broken when Yongdan and I loaded our burdens on our backs and continued the tramp through the forest. More than 24 hours had now elapsed since we had eaten and drunk. We had not yet become accustomed to prolonged fasts, and this first one was hard to bear. We proceeded as fast as we could in order to reach some stream before hiding ourselves for the day. It was a race with the sun, which was now rising rapidly. It appeared somewhere above a summit hidden in the thick foliage, and its heat soon began to light and warm the underwood. The time had come for us to take shelter in the forest. The men whom we had met during the night might overtake us, and that would mean a long talk, a lot of explanations, and, what was still worse, our showing ourselves in broad daylight. We crept between the thickets that extended beyond some dock odor until we were completely invisible from the path. Looking down, I discerned some blue smoke floating far below between the trees. A distant noise of running water could also be heard. Travelers or woodcutters were enjoying their morning meal, an idea which so increased our hunger that Yongdan decided to risk himself on the road with our kettle in search of water. While alone, I hid our baggage under some branches, and lay down flat on the dry leaves and threw others over me. Any wanderer through the wood could have passed very near without detecting my presence. Indeed, this happened to Yongdan when he came back with his kettle full of wafer. I had fallen asleep and he roamed a long time in the jungle looking for the place where he had left me. He did not dare to call aloud, and had I not been awakened by the noise he made in wading through the dry leaves and got up, he would have wandered still longer. We had discussed, during the previous night, the question of our disguise. Till then we had worn our Chinese robes, which would not have compromised us even if I were recognized as a white woman, for, as a rule, all foreigners in these remote parts of Tibet and China dress in this way. But we now hoped that no one who could detect us would come along our road. Our fellow travelers would probably be pilgrims from various regions of Tibet, and our best plan was to merge at once in their number, like inconspicuous, common Ajapas. The Ajapas are those mendicant pilgrims who, all through the year, ramble in thousands across Tibet, going from one to another of its sacred places. The Ajopa, not necessarily, but for the most part, belongs to the religious order, either as a monk or as a nun. He or she may be a true pauper or even a professional beggar, but the mass of them have homes and means of subsistence in their own countries, although they cannot afford to ride on horseback during their pious journeys. Some Ajapas start without any money and rely entirely upon charity during their pilgrimages. Others are not entirely penniless, but keep carefully the few coins they possess for the unlucky days when almsgivers are few or none. A third category is rich enough to purchase the simple food of the ordinary Tibetan diet. However, for the most part, the pilgrim passes easily from one to another of these different classes. A lama capable of reading the scriptures, who can perform the different lamaist ceremonies, and can, above all, act as exorcist and fortune teller, may at any time find himself so well provided with food, clothing, and even money, that he may dispense with begging for several months. On the other hand, the owner of a heavy purse may fall, be delayed on his way by other circumstances, or be robbed, a thing which happens frequently, and have to take his place, in the same day, amongst the poorest of his colleagues. I had chosen to travel as an Ajopa because it is the best disguise to pass without attracting notice. Yongdan, who is an authentic and well-read lama, looked his part perfectly, and I, his aged mother, who had undertaken a long pilgrimage for devotional reasons, constituted a rather touching and sympathetic figure. These considerations had their full weight when I decided upon our disguises, but, and why should I not confess it? The absolute freedom of the Ajopa, who, like Diogenes, carries all his possessions with him, and who is free from the care of servants, horses, luggage, sleeping each night where he pleases, attracted me greatly. I had had a taste of it during a previous short trip in Kham, and wished to enjoy it more fully and longer. And now that I have thoroughly experienced the joys and the hardship of the Ajapa's life in Tibet, I deem it to be the most blessed existence one can dream of, and I consider as the happiest in my life those days when, with a load upon my back, I wandered as one of the countless tribe of Tibetan beggar pilgrims. Apostrophe after a copious meal of tsampa, dried meat and buttered tea, we began to disguise ourselves. After all, was it really a disguise? Yongdan clad himself as a lama, as he did when residing in a monastery. As for me, I had for years accustomed myself to wearing Tibetan clothes, the only novelty being in the coarseness of the plain white lay dress I put on for the journey. The headgear caused me some little annoyance. I had brought no hat from Amdo, thinking that I would purchase one at Atuns. But I did not pass that town, and I could not find a hat in any of the villages on our way. For the time being, an old red belt would suffice, twisted around my head in the fashion of the Lhotskyang. The boots which I had brought from Kham showed, as well as the peculiar material of my dress, that we hailed from that province and provided me with a certificate of Tibetan nationality. 2 years previously, in another attempt of the same kind, I had cut my plaits. Now, in the part of a lay woman, I required long ones.